So the way that you're looking at the history, I take it, is that you're looking at the music history and saying, okay, but what did a mind from then actually do?
Right. One of the things that I've always been very interested in is the relationship between pedagogy and practice. Mm-hmm. You know, because the pedagogy, I think, strongly influences practice in a way that most musicians aren't comfortable admitting. Mm-hmm. And the reason that it strongly influences it is because it defines the scope of the universe that you're working with and the collection of concepts that you're working with. So I'm fascinated by that. What's the actual mental process, even though we can't actually get to it? That's my delusional fantasy of some sort of reconstructing of the techniques, the technology of the older musics, and how people, and when I say technology, I'm using the old Greek term sense of techne, thing made. Mm-hmm. And so species counterpoint is sort of like it's a manual, like an architecture manual would be, to how to construct one of these things. And so I'm fascinated by this relationship between these manuals on how to construct these things and then what people actually do with that, you know, with that information.
Do you ever have the urge to write a manual on how to construct the goings, artifacts that you make in this time period?
Occasionally, but like Mark Twain, I try to relax until the urge passes. I also have this kind of nihilist. I'm not terribly concerned about my existence after I'm dead. Mm-hmm. So I'm trying to get over this whole idea that what a composer is supposed to do is to erect this permanent monument to yourself. Mm-hmm. That will then sit there and cause traffic jams forever.
But nonetheless, you think Schoenberg's great, and Schoenberg was doing this as
well. Absolutely, because that's what I like when I hear it.
Yeah.
When I listen to the music, that's what fires me up. So yeah. That's
interesting that you wouldn't want it. That's what creates excitement in music for you. That you wouldn't want to create excitement that way.
Well, I would. Gonna put it. I think that a lot of composers are having imaginary dialogues with the other composers.
Yeah,
I mean, I see this like when you look at the canon writing and stuff. It's like, well, why would you write canons like this? And, you know, canons. All these composers write these canons that like don't really have any real usage in the world. But they're just sort of like letters to whom it may concern to send out into the universe, like putting a message in a bottle or sending the thing out into space with the Chuck Berry on it, you know? It's like...
I'm guilty, but I guess it has to do with that kind of fascination with schemes and background, you know, and background mechanics that are...
Yeah, it's like, hey, guys, look what I figured out you could do with this toy.
Exactly. You know, they give you plastic.
Here's my model of Paris built out of toothpicks.
Yeah. Right, exactly. So, just before we split from Columbia, let's talk about, okay,
we got to Pat Carpenter, we talked about...
But we didn't really get to the Minot thing, because now we got to get into the practice school.
Okay, so I studied with Pat Carpenter, and... She would have office hours on Friday afternoons that no one ever went to. And I figured out that no one was ever going. And so I started going every week. And she had a little coffee machine in her office, which was purple. Everything in the office was purple. Everything around her was purple. She was mad about purple.
The royal color.
The royal color. And I would go to her office, and she would make this tremendously strong coffee.
Nice.
And drink the coffee, and we would talk for hours. And I did this like every week for years. And it was like chatting, but then chatting about, you know, the deepest and most serious musical things that we could chat about.
Where was she from?
She was from California.
Uh-huh. From like Los Angeles?
I believe that she might have been from the Central Valley somewhere.
Wow.
But she went to UCLA. And
I mean, it's funny because from now on you're thinking of Central Valley. It's more like if you showed up like Merle Haggard, it seems like an unlikely candidate.
I believe she was. I mean, I believe she kind of was an unlikely candidate, you know, and she had this interest in this ability, and I think her story was kind of like mine. She accidentally wandered into this situation with this guy.
Yeah.
You know? And yeah, I mean, it's pretty bizarre. Like, that's much more bizarre than my story, to walk into the classroom and there's Arnold Schoenberg, you know, like as your teacher for your, you know, freshman harmony class.
Do you think she had an understanding of who he was in the beginning?
I have no idea.
I wonder. I mean, I'm just trying to. I it's so complicated to spot what the forces were at that point, you know, like what.
Well, the forces were very strange in general anyway, because at the same time, you know, that he had been widely recognized as being the greatest living composer, even though nobody liked his music.
No, but who was recognizing him? This is an interesting thing.
That was a thing that had already started in Vienna, you know, like where guys like Mahler and Strauss were like, well, this guy's the deal, but we don't really know what's going on with it, but we can sense that it's...
Who endowed Mahler and Strauss with the authority to decide whether Schoenberg was the guy?
I don't know that it works that way. I think that more likely they're just, you know, we're hanging out and they're helping out young composers, and along comes this guy and they're like, wow, this guy's like super intense, you know.
So there's popular appeal going on, though.
Well, he had, you know, he'd had a very successful touring around with Piero Lunera. He had been appointed the head of the composition program at the Hochschule für Musik in Berlin. Derek had the huge success with Wozzeck. Webern's conducting career was taking off. They were doing these ISCM, the International Society for Contemporary Music, concerts and festivals and things. You know, the future was looking very bright.
So these
and
guys,
then Hitler came.
Mm.
And you have to remember, Hitler conquered pretty much all of mainland Europe.
Mm.
And as Monod told me that he actually first encountered Schoenberg when they were climbing through the dumpster after the Nazis had gone through and thrown away and removed all the degenerate music from the conservatoire's library. And him and his friends were climbing around, and one of his friends is kind of like Gollum in the Ring. His friend finds the Piero Lunaire, and it's like, oh, look at this crazy thing I found by this, you know, guy. And Jacques somehow tricked him and got the score and never was the same.
Wow.
You know? Yeah, but literally, you know, so Monod actually encounters the Schoenberg climbing in the fucking dumpster because the Nazis went through and rewrote history.
They did that successfully. Do you think that's carried over?
I think that they did that successfully. I think that there's also, they did that in conjunction. That is to say, I think that their rewriting of the history fit very nicely with the general reactionary forces in music at the time, you know? So it's very nice to be able to have some sort of authority to denigrate this music that you don't like because it's too modern. Mm-hmm. And you don't like modern music very much, you know? I remember when I was a kid, they used to call it contemporary music. You know, it's like there was medieval music, there was Renaissance music, there was Baroque music, there was classical music, and there was Romantic music, and then there was
modern
contemporary
music?
We called it contemporary first. We didn't call it modern.
Modern first?
There's contemporary. Yeah. You know, when I was taking piano lessons and started to learn some Kabalevsky as a kid, it was billed as contemporary Bartok and such. Contemporary music.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah, and I think that those designations have really fucked things up for us because I don't know how to describe anything that I'm up to now. I find it objectively impossible because those designations have become so hardened in stone. So, you know, it's not like you can say now music. It's bad grammar.
I mean, you're unable to formulate the central marketing high concept.
I'm not even going for that. I'm just trying to say it's what we're up to now. Like somebody, because, you know, I had this discussion the other day, you know, Nicky Cat showed up at my gig the other day, and afterwards, I just played, and I get off, and Nicky says, well, what do you call that music? What is that? What kind of music is it you're playing? And I said, I don't know, it's that, you know.
That's what it is.
That's what you heard is what it is, you know, that's what it is. And and he said, it's atmospheric music, but you should learn how to say it in Spanish, which I thought was very
funny. That's a nice one. That's nice. Spanish, yeah, Spanish is cool because the French is art. That would be too obvious, you know. Spanish would be very nice.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I found myself over lunch trying to sort that out. But
I like the Tropicalismo. That's Caetano Veloso's name for the style, Tropicalismo. You know, it's like
Tropicalia, Tropicalismo, you know, those kinds of things. Yeah, that's right. It's wonderful. Okay, so the Schoenberg people. Okay, so we're still only on Pally Carpenter. What did you talk to her about in the Purple Office?
Okay, so the Purple Office things came up like, can a piece of music be true? Mm-hmm. Lots and lots of technical questions about pieces. And deep discussions about those sorts of things. Like the universe and everything. An awful lot of stuff about organic unity and how one accomplishes it and what it's about. And I think in her mind, it was not something that... I remember her saying one time about a piece where she was talking about something and I was like... Is this, you know, what's going on with this? And I remember her saying, she's talking about the organic unity, and she's saying, well, I think this is just the way these guys think. Mm. That is, I don't think that she looked upon the organic unity as an aesthetic choice that somebody makes. I think she thinks of it just more as the natural way that artists think.
Mm-hmm.
So we talked about things like that, you know, and other things like, and actually, okay, so this is how the segue to Minot happens. I was talking to her one day, and I'd been working a lot with 12-tone composing, and I was working with manipulating rows in a certain way that, like, where the row wouldn't necessarily just have the same form, but the row could actually wind up being reordered, because, say, if you took... I'm going to talk technically here. So if you divide the road into say, four trichords, four three-note groups, and then you've got those four entities floating around, and then you can handle those as chords, and once you handle them as chords, you can arpeggiate them, and then once you arpeggiate them, you can reorder them. Because you present them in different orders, because the order ceases to be the binding thing. But once you presented it in a new order, then that becomes something I would take as being cognitively available. And so you could. And so I was explaining this way of manipulating materials, and I was like, well, and so I realized now I can do anything I want with the row, but what makes the piece great is the what you decide to do with it. And she was like, that's exactly right. And I continued with, but I can't quite work out how to integrate the orchestration into this. And she said to me, maybe it's time for you to work with Munoz. Mm-hmm. And I kind of lodged that in the back of my mind, and I was still terrified of him, so I didn't go there at that point in time. Another time I was asking her about some stuff, and she said of a very famous American composer who will remain nameless for the time being, but who was very involved with surrealism, she said, he lies. And then I asked her what she thought about Munoz, and she said, I think he's right. And so this, again, I was like, whoa, okay. This cat's heavy, you know. Mm-hmm. And then I was finishing up my doctorate, and by this time there's a lot of postmodernism coming into the Columbia program via computer music, and you know the kind of funniness of the computer music world, and I'm attending these classes and concerts where, how can I put it? You know, at one point I remember the teacher was playing a piece that involved a woman, an old woman talking, and then slight computer effects on the voice as the piece is going by, and the woman who's teaching the class is trying to get a vigorous aesthetic discussion going, and I'm just like completely like over this by like years and years, you know, I don't need to have an aesthetic discussion. And she finally insists that I give my opinion, and I said, oh, well, I miss music. Because it seemed to me that the whole thing at that point was really literary associations and the power of suggestion replacing the fundamental thing that I had been in love with music. And around that same time that I'm being very disappointed by this, because I had also been involved going back then again, I did start playing in rock bands again around the last couple of years of my undergraduate, and I started playing in a band called the Malibu Dolphins with Steve Bernstein and David Capello, amongst others, and we were a crazy punk funk scene, and we were kind of the darlings of a very precious and beautiful little scene that was happening in the Lower East Side prior to the arrival of the Knitting Factory. And so I was going down and playing on these gigs with characters like Bobo Shaw and Luther Thomas.
Played with Willie Bobo Shaw?
Yeah, he was there. I didn't play with him. He was on other bands. He was hanging around that scene. And so I've been involved in this very counterculture, you know, a really vibrant counterculture world. And so then when this other kind of what I thought of as a pseudo-counterculture world that was really some sort of excuse for lazy white suburban kids to not have to learn counterpoint, you know, arose. I was tremendously disappointed that that's what was actually finding its way into the university,
mm-hmm.
as opposed to these really authentic, what I thought of as real authentic guys doing this vibrant stuff, like Wayne Kramer was hanging around that world, you know,
mm-hmm.
Who had actually been involved with revolution and stuff, you know, real honest like riots and things, and to see this other much more tame kind of, I guess I hate to use the term, but bourgeois sort of thing coming in. So I was very disappointed in this new stuff, and so I went to a Guild of Composers concert. Because I had these friends who were, I had a friend who was studying with Jacques, and so I went to the Guild of Composers concert, and it was deadly serious. You know, the players wore suits. It was given at the church. The performing was unbelievable. The quality of the performers was absolutely unbelievable. I believe they played Munoz Duo. At that concert, Munoz got up and made a speech, which was incomprehensible. He had to make a speech because they were getting money from Meet the Composers. But I believe that his speech, I believe that the topic of his speech was how talking about music is useless. Only given in, like, Wittgensteinian, like, I don't know. It was in this horrible French accent, and I frankly couldn't really follow it, but it seemed like it was some really crazy deep shit going on. And after the concert, I was just so impressed by the whole thing and frankly the aesthetic experience of the music that he had picked and that had been performed and the way it had been performed and the quality of the stuff. It was so elegant and so beautiful, and so it was shimmering, you know, it was just like this shimmering thing because it was tremendous. It wasn't at all the kind of hack accurate performance that was going on from most of the contemporary music scenes. I mean, these people were actually doing rubato and subtle phrasing. It was gorgeous. And so I signed up. I went up to Jacques after the concert and told him who I was and told him that I wanted to volunteer, you know, work as a volunteer for the Guild of Composers.